work, working on a home. Living in a mansion, might live in a dome. Might own guns, you might even own land. You might be somebody's landlord, or you might own a bank. But you got to serve somebody. Pride. You may be a councilman taking bribes on the side. Working in a barber shop, may know how to cut hair. Or maybe somebody's mistress, or maybe somebody's serve somebody. Might like to drink whiskey, might like to drink milk, might like to eat caviar, might like to eat bread, maybe sleeping on the floor, even on a king-size bed, but you gotta serve somebody.
Okay, Etta James there, and you know you got to serve somebody. Good morning, everyone. This is The Bee. Welcome to Labor and Love Radio on Mutiny Radio and MutinyRadio.fm. Coming at you this morning from 2781 21st Street in the Mero, the heart of the Mission District in San Francisco. This is the show where we tell you like it is. If one person gets a dollar they didn't work for, someone else worked for a dollar they didn't get. If you don't have a seat at the table, the negotiating table, that is, wherever you work, you're probably on the menu. And never but never let anyone into your heart who is not a friend of labor. And when I say labor, I mean you. Good morning, everybody. We had our opening set there. Started out, of course, with Deportees. Deportees by the Highwaymen. None other than Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Quite a group there. Johnny Cash singing lead there on Just Deportees. Much more about that in a bit. We had Traveling Soldier by the Dixie Chicks, about to the fact that every day somewhere American troops are involved in wars. Every day. This is for those soldiers who are out there, and also to get them back home. Wars where workers of one class shoot down workers of another class. Thin out the possibility of resistance to capitalism. And last, we had Etta James, Queen of the Blues, Gotta Serve Somebody. The Bob Dylan classic reminds us that, yes, your indecision, your hesitation, serve someone. By just standing around, you're rushing backwards. Okay, now I remarked about that case. We're talking about that case of deportees. And this is, the song, of course, relates the fact that even though these people have come to the United States and worked, you know, they're uncelebrated. No one remembers them. Just barely their names, and other than that, they'll be just deportees. The song was written by Woody Guthrie and popularized by Pete Seeger. Since then, it's been recorded by virtually everybody. Certainly in the country and Western genre. A Chicano writer named Tim Z. Hernandez decided that, yeah, that wasn't good enough. He wanted to go and find out who these people were. This is part of an interview on Latino USA on NPR. Here we go.
32 people on the plane. 4 Americans, including 3 crew members and an immigration official, and 28 migrant farm workers. Everyone died that morning, all in the same way. But they were not all treated the same after death. The 28 Mexican field workers on that plane were known as braceros. They had come here at the request of the U.S. government and were headed back to Mexico, but didn't make it. After the crash, only the remains of the 4 Americans were sent back to their families. The Mexican citizens were buried in a mass grave in California under a tiny plaque that read,
28 Mexican citizens who died in an airplane accident near Kalinga.
28 Mexican citizens. That's all they would call them. And for decades, that's all there was. No one identified the remains of the 28 passengers. No one asked for their families. No one really paid attention. Until a Mexican-American author came along. And it became personal. From NPR and Futuro Media, this is Latino USA. I'm Fernanda Chavarri, guest hosting today's episode, where we go back 70 years to find out the names of those 28 unnamed people and find out how one man made it his life mission to give them names. And to do that, I'm joined by producer Maggie Freeling. Hi, Maggie.
Hey, Fernanda. So when you and I found out about this incident that took place 70 years ago, we were talking about how these people were virtually forgotten. They were nameless in death and in the news. But the crash itself, it turns out that more people might know about it than they realize.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mi amigos, Jesus and Maria.
And it's all because of one song that kept the story alive throughout the decades, a song that has a very long, confusing title.
Deportee, parentheses, plane wreck at Los Gatos. And it's sung here by Pete Seeger, a super famous American folk music icon.
600 miles to that Mexico border. They chase us like outlaws and rustlers.
But Pete didn't write the song. He just made it famous in the 1950s. Pete's good friend Woody Guthrie wrote it.
When Woody heard about the crash on the radio, he felt this strong sense of injustice. So he wrote his feelings down as a poem, and it later became the song.
Who are all these friends all scattered like dry leaves? The radio says they are just departing.
Who are these friends who are scattered like dried leaves?
The radio said they were just deportees.
These kinds of poems and lyrics were not unusual for Woody Guthrie. He was always sort of a revolutionary.
Woody was kind of the embodiment of your quote-unquote everyman in the sense that he lived and worked and wrote and traveled among the people. I'm Nora Guthrie, and I'm Woody Guthrie's daughter.
We called Nora to find out why Woody wrote this.
There was a very strong similarity between the migrant workers in the 1930s and the Okies in the 1930s.
The Okies were farmers in Arkansas, Kansas, Tennessee, and, of course, Oklahoma. They lost their homes during the Dust Bowl and migrated to California. Woody Guthrie was one of these people.
When Woody came to California, he was homeless, living in tents and little tin shacks. And so were the Mexican field workers. They're kind of all in the same boat. And I think that just instinctively, he connected with their plight. He didn't start out to be political. He started out just being curious. So he would always dig further and further into the news reports. And that was what happened with the plane wreck at Los Gatos.
Somewhere along the way, Pete Seeger, who was Woody's friend, got a hold of the poem, set it to music, and started singing it. Then, the song got huge. It took on a life of its own and was covered by dozens of musicians.
Johnny Cash, Johnny Rodriguez.
The crops are all in, and the peaches are rotten.
Dolly Parton.
The oranges are parting.
Joan Baez.
You're so dumb.
They're flying.
Bob Dylan.
To the Mexico border. They got all the money we need.
Bruce Springsteen. And Woody's son, Arlo Guthrie.
Bye, Rosalita. Adios, mi amigos. Jesus y Maria.
So you have all these super famous all-American music icons singing about Mexican farm workers in the 1940s.
And it's really crazy because this song was sung throughout the decades, and yet nobody bothered to find out who these people were.
And my father left a lot of songs like this. Sometimes I call them like seeds to be harvested by the next generation. So the thing is that he left this song with the question, why weren't the deportees named?
You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane.
These were the words that kept humming in my head. All they will call you will be deported. All they will call.
I'm Tim Hernandez, and I'm the author who's been working on this plane wreck at Los Gatos for the last 7 years.
And the name of your book is?
The name of my book is All They Will Call You.
So here's where Tim comes in. He's a professor and an author, so he's always sort of digging for stories. One day, Tim was doing research for something unrelated back in 2010 when he came across a newspaper article.
And it said 100 people see an airplane fall out of the sky, ship plunge to earth, and it was a farm labor accident.
So Tim was like, weird, that sounds familiar. And he realized that it was the same story as the one he knew from the song. And the same way that Woody Guthrie was bothered by the injustice decades ago, Tim, too, wanted resolution for the families of the victims. So Tim set off on a quest.
You know, I just let my curiosity sort of pull me, and I began to ask, who is all, and who are they, and what do they call you? And that's just what kept me going. That was
a quest that, over the years, became more and more personal for Tim, as he saw the similarities between his life growing up in the Central Valley and the migrant farm workers who died that day.
You know, growing up, the son of migrant farm workers, I saw firsthand the moments where my family felt voiceless, and I started to see them play out as I got older, not beyond my family. I'd see them play out in the broader community, you know.
Tim put himself in the shoes of these 28 families and thought, this could have been me. This could have been my family.
I was born and raised here in California's San Joaquin Valley, the agricultural hub here. My parents were actually migrant farm workers originally from South Texas and New Mexico. You know, kind of growing up with migrant family, you know, we traveled a lot, quite a bit, working in different fields and different harvests throughout the year. And my parents did that pretty much, you know, up until, I don't know, I was about maybe 8 or 9.
And although Tim's family didn't participate in the Bracero program, they did spend generations working the fields in Texas and California.
Farming is America's biggest industry. All such farm jobs, which are tough, dirty, or unpleasant, are generally referred to as stoop labor.
The Bracero program, to summarize, was a seasonal worker program that was a sort of amicable agreement between the U.S. and Mexico that went on from the early 40s to the mid-60s.
Braceros.
At that time, the U.S. desperately needed workers to pick fruits and vegetables.
It isn't easy to find men willing to take on such undesirable kinds of work. Understandably, then, the American farm labor supply falls short and is supplemented by Mexican citizens.
So they gave Mexican farm workers temporary permits to come here and do the work. Millions of Mexican workers came and went.
When the harvesting season was over and the U.S. government didn't need them anymore, they would send them back by train or fly them by plane.
And that morning, that's exactly what was happening. Those 28 migrant workers were flying from San Francisco to El Centro, right on the border with Mexico, in a U.S. government chartered plane.
So based on Tim's research and interviews with the families over the years, here's what happened after the crash. Officials recovered as many scattered body parts as they could. Then, they formally notified the families of the four Americans and sent them caskets of pieced together remains, some as far as upstate New York.
As for the Mexican passengers, the leftover body parts were also put in caskets, but they were not sent back to Mexico. They were buried in that mass grave we mentioned earlier. 14 on one side, 14 on the other, in Fresno, California.
So the Mexican passengers' bodies were never repatriated. Some families in Mexico were notified by the Mexican government via letter. Others only heard about it on the radio. It's unclear exactly how each of the families found out, and if they even knew where their loved ones were buried.
We reached out to the Mexican government officials at the embassy in D.C., but were denied an interview. Of course, we weren't going to find people working there who were working for the Mexican government 70 years ago, but we wanted to know how the government handled this. An official said via email that today their policy is to help families in Mexico find funeral homes and cremation services in the U.S., and that based on the family's financial need, the Mexican government can help them pay for part of the cost of getting their remains back to Mexico.
We also wanted to know how only some of the victims of the crash ended up identified. So to find out, we flew to meet Tim Hernandez in California.
This is all cattle territory up here. It's Los Gatos Canyon. It's all ranchers.
In fact, Larry's family were cattle ranchers up there.
They
were.
Correct.
And oh my God, did you see the baby cows? I'm sorry.
I know.
They were the cutest little baby cows.
Did you see the big long horns earlier?
Yes. Yeah.
We're driving to Coalinga, about an hour southwest from Fresno, with Tim and his friend Larry Hawes. Larry's a Harley-riding, leather-vest-wearing white guy.
He's sort of Tim's sidekick and an unofficial historian of his own family, the family that owned the property where the plane crashed 70 years ago.
It's hard. Every turn looks the same here, unless you know exactly where the crash happened. So then that's what prompted me to want to call, find Larry's, the Gaston family, so that I could identify exactly where it happened.
I have to ask, what are we driving through? What is this?
This is called the oil patch, and this is the Coalinga oil field. And this is, Coalinga is actually Coaling Station A.
Oil was actually discovered here. And today, there's a whole bunch of industrial oil derricks covering a huge part of a barren desert area.
The plane would have been able to see these oil derricks as it was coming in here this way. And because he had crash landed that airplane twice before, it makes sense. One could actually, you know, you could surmise from that he was more than likely looking for a strip of dirt to land on. You know, there's nothing you could do.
Crash landed it twice?
That same exact airplane he had crash landed twice before.
Okay, so it wasn't the exact plane, but the kind of plane, a Douglas DC-3, which back in the 30s and 40s was a pretty revolutionary plane. Frank Atkinson, the pilot, was used to flying and crash landing the DC-3.
So he thought he could land that plane again, and he might have been able to, if all that was wrong was a plane malfunction, but...
plane wing broke off, and it started spinning out of control and throwing people out.
So we're here?
Yeah, we are.
We're going through the barbed wire fence. All right.
I'm so short.
This barely works.
This is the actual crash site, and this was where the main bodies were at, and dead people were everywhere right where we're standing.
Larry wasn't born when the plane crashed, but growing up, he heard stories about that day and about how his family raced to the scene to help in any way they could.
Larry's mom and his Aunt June were little girls at the time. His Aunt June was 9 years old when she saw the wreckage and is the only surviving witness in Larry's family.
June was standing, you know, not too far off here looking at and eyewitnessing all this.
June is turning 80 soon, and she still remembers it all in very graphic detail. So we called her to get her account of what happened.
We saw bushes with brains hanging on it, and my thought then, as a little girl, that looks like decorating a Christmas tree. It was just all over with these brains.
At the time, June didn't realize the impact this would have on her beyond the trauma of witnessing a crash.
Do you remember, as you got older, learning more about it?
I do remember because my mother was following it in the papers. And I remember her shortly after that saying, this has become an international incident because they've buried all of these people together in a mass grave. Then that really occurred to me how really terrible that was, that they were just demeaning these people because they weren't us. By leaving their name off, I finally came to see what an insult it was.
Tim also felt like the 28 people who died that day were not treated humanely or equal to the families of the American passengers.
So he wanted to right that wrong. Tim felt that these braceros were sort of invisible in life. And then in death, they weren't even given a name.
In some big dream I might have in the future, maybe put some kind of a headstone marker with their names on it.
So first, he went to the cemetery in Fresno where the mass grave is. He wanted to see the plot. So he asked Carlos Rascon, the cemetery director, to show him.
After they walked over and saw the tiny plaque in the back of the cemetery that read 28 Mexican citizens, Tim asked Carlos to see the cemetery's ledger of names. Surely the cemetery would have a record of who was buried there, right? But when Carlos pulled it out of the archives...
It just said, Mexican nationals 28 times.
At this point, Carlos also wanted to find their names. He wanted to know who was buried in his cemetery. So Carlos joined Tim on his search, which led them to one more place, the Hall of Records in Fresno. That's the place that keeps all birth and death certificates.
And it was there that they were finally able to get a list of names.
But they quickly realized that list was unreliable. In Mexico, you usually have two last names, your maternal last name and paternal last name, and so many of them were treated as first names. There was somebody with the last name Lara that was turned into a woman named Laura.
And many of the names in Spanish were turned into Italian names. So they knew right away this list was botched.
The fact that they were misspelled, it kind of maybe shows a little bit of who might have been behind the pen or the books.
Sure enough, there had always been a list with the names. But why didn't it make it to the cemetery?
I would think that it was a very sad oversight, I would say.
So there they were with an actual list of names in their hands for the first time, and it was wrong.
But then, Carlos remembered that every November, on the Day of the Dead, someone came by to leave flowers at the mass grave. Someone was visiting a loved one. This was Tim's first real clue that these people were not totally forgotten.
He wanted to find who that person was. So Tim put out a call on the local paper in Fresno that said, if you or someone you know is related to any of the 28 Mexican passengers who died in that plane crash in 1948, contact me. And someone did. That's coming up after the break.
Okay, and we'll take a break here too. Play the rest of that later in the show. So far, Tim Hernandez, the Chicano writer, has decided to find out the names of those people and not leave them just being deportees. Great story. Okay, here's some poetry by Jack Kerouac and Steve Allen.
I had a slouch hat, too, one time. The old slouch hat. I just keep walking around, and he keeps walking around with me, around and around that necktie counter we went. When it rained, I wore my old slouch hat. It was a good felt that I had to carry through many rainy days, late fall and early spring. Perhaps it was a rainy day, and the house dick might have saw my hat. Each tie on that ring worth $6. Brooks Brothers. $60 worth of ties. Slacks with peculiarities. I couldn't even find a pair of slacks I thought it was suitable to wear. Wrapped one pair around me and pinned it in with a safety pin. Pulled up my trousers and went out and looked at myself in the mirror. Oh no, those won't do. And I walked out. Wrapped the slacks around my waist. Took two other pair, went to the mirror, threw them at the salesman. No, those won't do. Good afternoon, and walked out. The slouch hat I got at Harvard Club, Yale Club, Princeton Club, or one of the other Dartmouth Club, University Club. Always barred the Yacht Club, because it was a little over my kin. Because the doorman knew that only Mr. Astor, Mr. Vanderbilt, and Mr. Whitney belonged. He couldn't say, good morning, Mr. Astor, because he knew I wasn't Mr. Astor. I always figured a way to heel into those other clubs. Not only a member of Who's Who, but a Who's Who also have to be a member of Who's Who in New York in the special clique of Who's. I'd get in the athletic club many times. And I'd go up in the billiard room, and I would wander back around the room, hands in back, and every coat rack I backed up against the feel for the wallet. One day I walked out of there with 10 wallets. Bellboy looking me over. Pretty soon a very dignified looking gentleman come up and buzzed the bellboy. He says, who? And I says, man told me his name while we're drinking at the bar and told me to meet him in this billiard room at the athletic club. I don't see him, so I better go. Well, tell me about the old slouch hat. Oh, one of my numerous trips to one of the numerous clubs in New York City. The hat finally was left in the hotel, which I had to leave rather hurriedly one night, never to return. So the hat was given to the cast-offs of the hotel, which they collect and rummage sells. It may now be worn by one of the members of Skid Row, New York City, the Bowery. I seen that hat by moonlight. Yeah. I had a pointed mustache, and I mean pointed, half inch from here. Double-breasted vest and a derby hat and striped trousers, English shoes, black, very pointed. They were Hannah shoes. People on Broadway turn and look at me. The worst is yet to come. I had a pince-nez with a long black ribbon to my buttonhole, and I wore a carnation, white or red. Boy, did I look like something. A year later, I got caught. I was dressed differently and everything, but boy, that mustache and that pince-nez was really out of this world. I used that outfit 6 months. Finally had to pack it in because it was too well worn. Pince-nez was in a coat I stole. Mustache I grew in the sanitarium while taking one of my numerous drug cures. My mother come to see me, she says, oh no, cut it off. I'm just having a little fun, mother. Took it on the lam and went to Canada. Late at night, I'm full of morphine and I come down full of goofballs too. This guy had a ventriloquist doll and he gave out this Texas Guinan routine. Hello, sucker. We like your money as well as anybody else's. As a matter of fact, the bigger your role, the more we take you. He used to get everybody interested with the doll and cut out silhouettes, put stripes in your tie. Wound up in his room, gave him a shot of morphine. Out on the highway, I thumbed a ride into Buffalo. and I put the bum on the guy for something to eat. He said, eat in my drugstore. So we went in the back and he had corn on the cob and boiled potatoes. Say, fella, I always hear people talk about morphine. What's it look like? He shows me. He had a key, a cabinet. He had bottles of hundreds, quarter grains, half grains, Penapon, Dilaudid, everything. As soon as he tended the customers, I emptied the bottles. Got out of there pretty quick, bought a safety pin in Buffalo and took a shot in the toilet. Come out and saw a fella shaving, his coat hanging there. Hung my own coat and gave his coat a brush in my hand. Felt his wallet, washed my hands, went out and took off with the wallet. So I started out on a shoplifting campaign in Buffalo. It was about 1910. Wasn't very experienced at it. Started out with a top coat and sold it in the taxi cab stand. Next day I decided to get myself some suits and I went up and I had a suit box and I walked about and put the suit box in one of the dressing rooms, looked and fooled in the mirror, went out and I hawked those two. Next day, like a damn fool, go out to the same store, but I got a newspaper instead of a suit box. Thought I'd try a new routine. Two guys kind of watching me. I went in, wrapped myself up, two suits, went in the elevator. Bottom gentleman tapped me on the arm. Will you come with me, please? And the county jail, they ate breakfast. You got oatmeal with one spoonful of molasses. For lunch, stew, mostly bones, graveyard stew. And for supper, dinner at night, beans. And you couldn't smoke.
It's been a bad week for Jenny's ex-husband. The great Jenny.
No estoy pidiendo joyas, ni pieles, ni palacios. Mi alfombre, las calles al pasar, tampoco es que yo exija ni tierras ni riquezas, más que estar recibiendo. Me gusta regalar, tan solo estoy pidiendo. Ojalá comprendiera que estoy desesperada buscando quien se entregue como me entrego yo.
Do 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 do
We do the work. This is our day.
Okay, that was a random set. We had, first of all, Jack Kerouac from an album that he made with Steve Allen, the pianist, Poetry for the Beat Generation. That was Slouch Hat by Jack Kerouac. And then from Jenny Rivera, the late Jenny Rivera, late of... born and raised in Long Beach, California. And the bad news this week for her ex, Esteban Loyasa, hope I'm getting that right, who was a pitcher for a while, a very accomplished pitcher, an all-star, started the all-star game for the American League, won 20 games with the Chicago White Sox. Was arrested in just across the border here in California with a big catch of cocaine that was in a secret room in his house. Jenny sang, "Ni princesa ni esclava. I'm not a princess, but I'm not a slave, just a woman." And John Fromer there, another late comrade, brother, John Fromer, with We Do the Work. What I want to do now is finish the deportees documentary. Tim Z. Hernandez's attempt to find out who those 28 deportees were, the ones who are sung about in the famous Woody Guthrie song. Here we go.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whose bodies had been buried in a mass grave under a plaque that read 28 Mexican citizens. And not long after Tim put out the call, he got a response.
Someone gave me a piece of newspaper and said, look, they're talking about your grandpa's plane crash.
This is Jaime Ramirez. We met him in Fresno with Tim.
And I started reading it. He said, and I got my computer and I started...
Jaime went to his computer and started writing Tim an email. He wrote in Spanish. I know about the accident because that's where my maternal grandfather, named Ramon Paredes, and my uncle, Guadalupe Ramirez Lara, were killed. Jaime then included his address.
My phone number.
And ended with, if you need information, just let me know.
Anything that you want to know, just...
Yeah. What do you need to know? I'm right here. I was like, wow. And so that was really hopeful. Your email, as short as it was and as quick as it had so much hope inside of it. And so I was excited to meet you right away, yeah.
And not only is Jaime a surviving family member, but Tim didn't have to go to Mexico. Jaime was right there in Fresno. Jaime owns a restaurant called Ole Frijole, and everyone in Fresno knows the restaurant. Most of the employees there are related to Jaime, and they're descendants of two of the passengers from the plane crash, his uncle and his grandpa.
So when he first told me that that was his restaurant, I said, no, I said, you're kidding, because I've been there since I was a kid. You know, I've been going there. I'm sure I've seen you before, and that's my restaurant. And I said, it's legendary. And he said, yeah, it is.
You were looking for me, and I was right there.
And Jaime was there all along in more than one way. Remember the flowers that someone was putting on the mass grave on Dia de los Muertos?
And I said, wow, you know, I wonder who that person is. Later on, I would learn that it was...
It was you?
Yeah. Yes, I was in Salinas.
It was Jaime. He's the one that was putting flowers on the grave. He was Tim's first found family member. And turns out, he was also Tim's golden ticket.
The newspaper that my grandmother kept, and I kept it, I don't know why.
So here's what happened. Not long after the crash in 1948, a small Spanish language newspaper published an article that listed every passenger with the correct spelling of both last names.
And it had all the names and where they were from in Mexico. The little towns.
This was it. 3 years of searching, and Tim finally had their names. Independent newspaper, El Faro. Very old. It looks like it's a front page, right?
Yeah, it is. It is the front page.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's a front page, and in the front page you have the two photos of a priest looking over the bodies for the funeral service. On the right side is the column that has all of the names, first, last name, where they're from, the names of their parents or wives if they knew them. Wow, I'm gonna try to translate that as beautifully as it is written in Spanish. Mm-hmm. On Saturday, the 31st of January, that just passed, there was a funeral for the 28 compatriots that were chosen by destiny to perish in an unfortunate accident near Coalinga, California. Like, just the way that this is written is super, like, old newspaper.
It's very poetic,
but it's really poetic.
It's very poetic. In fact, even the biblical sort of...
Seeing how the Spanish language paper wrote about the 28 Mexican victims made it even more clear just how differently their deaths were treated and how their remains were handled. 28 families without closure, without being able to have a physical place to mourn. And although, yes, most of the families knew how their sons, brothers, and husbands had died, they didn't get to have a funeral or a place to visit their loved one, lay flowers, just grieve. And as any cemetery director would know, Carlos says there is an importance to being able to visit someone's grave.
It just, a sense of emptiness, like, wait a minute, you know, it's not just... some John Doe that got, you know, no family, indigent, nobody knows. There was information, and so it left kind of a blank there, like, wait a minute, you know.
So now, with the full names spelled correctly, Tim, Carlos, and Jaime could start the process of making a proper headstone with all the names on it. And they would also travel to Mexico to try and find other families. Tim wanted to tell them that their loved ones were no longer in a nameless mass grave. So So the first family Tim wanted to meet was Jaime's. Remember, both his grandfather and great-uncle died in the crash. So Tim and Jaime got on a plane and flew to Guanajuato in central Mexico. They were there on the 67th anniversary of the crash. Jaime set up a meeting with his family. And right at 10:40 a.m., the time when the plane crashed, they had a moment of silence. During the trip, Jaime told Tim a little more about his grandfather and great-uncle. Guadalupe and Ramon grew up in Charco de Pantoja, a farming community in Guanajuato. When they got older, they both owned land and farmed garbanzo beans, wheat, and alfalfa.
But their town struggled to get an irrigation system in place. They didn't have the money to get it set up. That's when the idea to go work in the fields in California came up.
So they both went back and forth working as braceros and bringing money back to their town.
Do you remember stories growing up about them?
Yeah. It's my tío. Ahí está la traducción. Sí. Era muy contento. Le gustaba andar a caballo. Y le gustaba tirar balazos. Sí, le gustaba, sí.
His uncle liked horse riding and to just like shoot up bullets in the air.
Mi papá me decía que iba al pueblo. Oía los balazos y decía, es el pelos de elote. Así le llamaban a mi tío porque estaba muy güero.
His uncle was so blonde that they called him corn hair. Yes. Like pelos de elote.
Jaime's family is split between Fresno, California and Guanajuato. And these are the types of stories that have been keeping his grandfather alive in Jaime's memory. So for Jaime to tell his family, his mother mostly, that her father would no longer be buried under a nameless headstone, it was life-changing.
Now we know who the people are. Now we know who their lives are, who their family are. We know how they are in this community.
So on September 2nd, 2013, the new headstone was unveiled in the cemetery. These braceros, who were once invisible and forgotten under a mass grave, had their names on a big, beautiful marble headstone.
Miguel Negrete Álvarez,
Francisco Llamas Durán,
Santiago García Elizondo,
Rosalío Padilla Estrada,
Bernabé López García,
Ramón Paredes González,
Tomás Aviña de Gracia,
Guadalupe Ramírez Lara,
Severo Medina Lara.
And this moment of having these names carved into stone forever, this is what Tim and Jaime wanted for years.
Manuel Calderón Merino,
Luis Cuevas Miranda,
Martín Razo Navarro,
Ignacio Pérez Navarro,
Román Ochoa Ochoa,
Apolonio Ramírez Plasencia,
Alberto Carlos Raigosa,
Guadalupe Hernández Rodríguez,
María Santana Rodríguez,
Juan Valenzuela Ruiz,
Wenceslao Flores
José
Ruiz,
José Valdivia Sánchez,
Jesús Mesa Santos,
Baldomero Marcas.
Around the edges of the headstone are 32 leaves for the song that says, "Who are these friends all scattered like dry leaves?"
Which brings us back to the song.
Who are all these friends now scattered?
Folk musician Pete Seeger, just like Tim, was always curious about his friend Woody Guthrie's inspiration for the poem. When Tim was working on this back in 2013, Pete actually gave him a call.
Hi, this is Pete Seeger, trying to get a message to Tim Hernandez. I'd like to talk to you.
Pete also wanted to know, who were these people? And Tim had the answer.
Did you ever think, Pete, you know, singing that song at any point that maybe someday someone would answer that, who are these friends?
No. And you took it on as a job that God would want done.
Tim wound up meeting Pete in person, where he told him the names of the 28 passengers. And then, in commemoration, Pete played Deportee, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos.
Goodbye to my Juan. Goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos. Jesus y Maria.
Tim wouldn't know it, but this would be the last time Pete would sing the song.
When you
he died a few months later.
All who will call you will be deportees.
And those friends who were scattered like dry leaves had all been memorialized together in the end. The the headstone also included the names of the four American crew members. Because as Tim saw it, leaving them out would be perpetuating the same kind of omission, that erasure that started all of this in the first place. And since Tim had been in touch with the American families for a while, they were able to travel to Fresno and attend the ceremony at Holy Cross Cemetery. Jaime was there too. And at one point, a brown SUV pulled up and Jaime's brother Guillermo got out. He opened the door and helped his 77-year-old mother, Caritina Paredes Murillo, step out. She was a kid when her father died in the crash.
My mother also, I think she said that she felt like she was in the actual burying ceremony.
Oh, because she never got to do an actual funeral. So yes, for her, this was really the first, as if it was happening like, decades ago.
Yes, yes. She felt like that, like she was burying her father.
And when you're standing here right now, what are you thinking about?
Muy contento, en español. Muy contento porque se les está dando un reconocimiento a ellos que nadie siquiera se los hizo.
He's happy that there's recognition and honoring of them, finally, in this community at least, because they didn't really get any recognition or anything anywhere else.
Estuvieron en la oscuridad, se le puede llamar.
They were in darkness, you could say. In the shadows, almost.
In the shadows, sí.
And I'll never forget when we asked her, you know, how do you feel, Caritina? And she said, well, I'm crying, and I don't know if they're tears of joy or tears of pain, you know.
After hearing the deportee song play a few times during the ceremony, the Ramirez family requested that mariachis play Mexico Lindo y Querido.
Mexico Lindo y Querido.
Si muero lejos de ti.
Que digan que estoy dormido y que me
traigan.
Mexico Lindo y Querido. Si muero lejos de ti.
The song lyrics say, my dear and beautiful Mexico, if I die far away from you, say that I'm sleeping, so they can bring me back to you. After meeting with Jaime's family, Tim continued traveling in Mexico and the U.S. trying to answer Woody Guthrie's question, who are these friends? And as of today, Tim has been able to connect with the relatives of six of the 28 Mexican passengers. So he's still searching.
As the chair of the California Latino Legislative Caucus, I rise to recognize a tragic incident that occurred 70 years ago.
2 weeks ago, on the 70th anniversary of the crash, the California State Senate held an emotional ceremony to formally recognize, for the first time in history, the 28 Mexican victims of the plane crash. Senator Ben Hueso stood next to Jaime and other surviving family members as they held photos of their relatives. And the Senate didn't forget to honor the man who spent 7 years of his life making this all possible.
Tim Hernandez did the work that the government should have done. But 70 years later, they will be remembered as a valued part of the history of our state.
This story was produced by me, Fernanda Chavarri, and Maggie Freeling. It was edited by Nadia Raymond. The Latino USA team includes Marlon Bishop, Andres Caballero, Antonia Cerejido, Jeannie Montalvo, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler. Our production manager is Natalia Fiedelholtz. Our interns are Stephanie Cano and Reese Williams. Special thanks to Tim Hernandez. His book, All They Will Call You, is out now. Our theme music was...
I don't like the government where I live. like police dogs sniffing round my feet. I don't like communist censorship of my books. I don't like Marxists complaining about my looks. I don't like Castro insulting members of my sex. Leftists insisting we got the mystic fix. I don't like capitalists selling me gasoline coke. Multinationals burning Amazon trees to smoke. Big corporation take over media mind. I don't like the top bananas that are robbing Guatemala banks blind. I don't like the KGB, Gulag, concentration camps. I don't like the Maoist Cambodian death dance. 15 million were killed by Stalin, the terrorist war. He's killed our red revolution forevermore. I don't like anarchists screaming love is free. I don't like the CIA, they killed John Kennedy. Paranoid tanks sit in Prague and Hungary. But I don't like counter-revolution paid for by the CIA. Tyranny in Turkey or Korea, 1980. I don't like right-wing death squad democracy. Police state Iran, Nicaragua yesterday. They say fair play, government keep the secret police off of me. No hope communism, no hope capitalism, yeah. Everybody's lying on both sides, yeah, yeah, yeah. The bloody Iron Curtain of American military power is a mirror image of Russia's Red Babel Tower. Jesus Christ was spotless but was crucified by the mob. Law and order heralds, hired soldiers did the job. Flower power's fine, but innocence has got no protection. The man who shot John Lennon had a hero worshipper's connection. The moral of this song is that the world is in a horrible place. Scientific industry devours the human race. Police in every country armed with tear gas and tea leaf. Secret masters everywhere bureaucratized for you and me. Terrorists and police together build a lower class rage. Propaganda murder manipulates the upper class stage. Can't tell the difference between a turkey and a provocateur. If you're feeling confused, the government's in there for sure. Aware, aware, wherever you are, no fear. Trust your heart, don't ride your paranoia, dear. Breathe together with an ordinary mind. Ponder humor, feed and help enlighten, oh mankind. Stayed at home.